Legacy Finance Committee to order. We have a quorum. We'll do approval of the minutes first from March 18, 2026. Representative Burkle, would you like to move the minutes?
I have reviewed the minutes and I'd like to move their adoption.
All right. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. All right. For today's agenda, we're just doing a lot of informational hearings and updates from the funds. A first update will be regarding the cart barrier update. I think this is part of a request for extensions. And so we'll have the DNR come to the testifying table. Kelly Pennington from DNR. Welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Kelly Pennington. I'm the Invasive Species Unit Supervisor at the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Thank you for the opportunity to provide an update on the invasive carp deterrent at Lock and Dam 5 on the Mississippi River. This deterrent is a part of the project Protecting Upper Mississippi from Invasive Carp, which was recommended for funding by the Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council in 2024. Since we received this appropriation in July 2024, we at the DNR have been working with an interagency team of invasive carp experts and managers, including biologists and engineers who have worked on the other two selective invasive carp deterrents in the U.S., and also including the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. With that interagency technical team, we first scoped criteria for a deterrent at Lock and Dam 5. We entered into a contract with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. They provided an assessment of deterrent options at Lock and Dam 5, and we selected a deterrent type and finalized a design proposal to enable the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to move forward with their project management plan and design schedule. Working closely with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on this project has many benefits and efficiencies because they own Lock and Dam 5 and have experience designing invasive carp deterrents. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is currently working on the first stage of the design, which will include plans and specifications for the deterrent and its components. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers project management plan currently estimates the next stage of design will be complete in July 2026. That stage will allow us to begin some additional permitting steps. And based on the current project management plan, we anticipate the full deterrent design will be complete by February 2027. We still anticipate that construction on the Lock deterrent can take place during the winter of 2027 to 2028 within the original appropriation deadline of June 2029. We also identified in our accomplishment plan to the Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council that effective invasive carp management at Lock and Dam 5 will require more than just the Lock deterrent. So we have proposed multiple strategies, including a trap and sort system that would remove invasive carp from the river and may have potential to help native fish pass the Lock and Dam. We're also looking into potential methods for deterring invasive carp from passing through open dam gates, and we are continuing our current program of tagging, tracking, and removing invasive carp from the river. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take questions.
All right, thank you. Any questions from the committee? All right, well, thank you so much, Kelly Pennington.
Thank you.
All right, we have next on the agenda is update from Parks and Trails. Emmett Mullen, Laura Price, and Renee Mattson, if you can make your way to the testifying table. Please feel free to identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good
Good morning. Renee Mattson, Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission.
I'm Laura Preuss, Madam Chair and members. Laura Preuss with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Parks and Trails Division. Thank you for having us here today.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Emmett Mullen with the Metropolitan Council and the Metropolitan Regional Parks and Trails System.
Thanks for having us here today. It's always nice to be in front of this committee and talk about what's going on in parks and trails across the state because it's a lot of fun. That's where people have fun. Today, we're going to talk about one of our shared projects. So the 25-year Parks and Trails Legacy Plan is a great format by which all of the different partners follow the strategy laid out by a lot of planning that happened many years ago to direct us in the 25 years that we have the funds for clean water, land, and legacy. And the strategic directions identified in that plan were connect people in the outdoors, very important, acquire land, create opportunities, take care of what we have, something that sometimes gets forgotten but an incredibly important pillar, and then coordinate among partners. And that's what we're going to focus on a bit today because it's one of those kind of forgotten pillars. It's always fun to talk about the other three, but coordinate among partners sometimes is nebulous. What does that mean, really? So we're going to talk today about a project that we have done the last year that was really exciting across all three systems. In addition to the coordinate among partners of specific project we'll talk about, the coordination among partners also means working together with the Parks and Trails Legacy Advisory Committee, doing joint projects. A few years ago, we did a wonderful project to determine user visits in state parks and the regional park systems. And then most recently is our Minnesota Parks Artist in Residence Program, or MinPair. You were all given a pin today that symbolizes that project. And we'll be talking about that as well as a lot of other updates that have happened in our systems over the past year since we were last year sharing our information with you. So with that, I will turn it over to Laura.
It's actually me.
I'm sorry,
this has been
it's
highly
all came
choreographed.
Up really fast.
Again, Emmett Mullen with the Metropolitan Council and the Metropolitan Regional Parks and Trails System. Thank you all for having us today. This is a photo that I love from Battle Creek Regional Park here in Ramsey County. And it highlights snowmaking facilities that were funded with Legacy. And I can't tell you how much snowmaking on the east side of the region has opened up opportunities for so many people. And this is just a fun photo from that. As an aside, Battle Creek is one of Jesse Diggins' favorite systems. I'm not making that up. So, collaboration and cooperation. At the heart of the Parks and Trails legacy work is our commitment to collaboration and cooperation, witnessed here today with my partners, Renee and Laura, as well as with our 10 regional park implementing agency partners, many of whom are in the audience today. The map on the slide is the most recent data. We've been working really hard on our mapping, showing the Metropolitan Regional Park implementing parks and trails, but also the 10 agencies that you probably can't read, but Anoka County to Three Rivers Park District. So, again, regional parks and state parks, we're large nature-based parks and trails. And we have a really large nature-based system here in the metropolitan area that provides a lot of green space. We have 58 regional parks and trails. We have nearly 500 miles of regional trail for hiking and biking. And we have over 65,000 acres of land that's been protected. And Legacy is central to all of that work. The Parks and Trails Legacy Fund, it's making a huge difference. I cannot state that more definitively in the metro area, protecting land and increasing access to healthy opportunities. These are just two projects, but I could have picked projects from tens, if not hundreds, of legacy-funded projects. The one on the left is Blakely Bluffs Park Reserve that's in Scott County. And this is a park reserve that's not yet open to the public, but we're getting really close. And thanks to the Legacy Fund, we're able to work with willing sellers to get that done. On the right-hand side is just down the Minnesota River. In Dakota County is the Minnesota River Greenway Regional Trail. And this was a legacy-funded kind of rest area, but also an interpretive site talking about the Dakota people and how they're here today and they were here, before. Next slide. This is my final slide, and this is a fun slide, I think, from the Parks Artist in Residence program. This is part of our connecting people in the outdoors pillar. Those are the four pillars that Renee went over as she kicked off this presentation. And this is just kind of a fun Parks Artist in Residence program that we've worked on together, where we leverage the talents of artists to help us create welcoming spaces in our parks and trails. The picture on the left of the boy surrounded by what looks to me like palm fronds is from Spring Lake Park Reserve in Dakota County. On the far right, that's from North Mississippi Regional Park in the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board system. I wanted to focus on the middle one just because I thought it was kind of a cool example of an artist-led walk. It was a water walk at Battle Creek Regional Park, again here, right in our backyard in St. Paul. And it was celebrating water, praying for water, and praying for water's healing ways within the American Indian community. So really cool project. I'll turn it over to Laura, who's going to go next.
Thank you, Amit. Madam Chair, members, again, I'm Laura Preuss with the DNR's Parks and Trails Division. So happy to be here today to give you a brief overview of our legacy work and our partnership work. This slide provides you with an overview of the systems that we manage in DNR's Parks and Trails Division. On the left side of the slide, you see a table that gives a sense of the scope of what we manage. That includes state parks and recreation areas, state trails and grant and aid trails, as well as state forest recreation areas and a whole set of water recreation systems. The Parks and Trails Legacy Fund is focused largely on the left side of the table. In our state parks and recreation areas, you see 73 state parks and recreation areas. You see the more than 5,000 camping and lodging units, the 240,000 acres of land that we manage. State trails, you see, for example, 25 state trails. With many of those, 2,700 miles are designated, and a little more than half of those are developed. And so that just is a broad overview. And one thing I'd like to highlight on the right side of the slide as you look at the map, you'll see that those parks and trails are located throughout the entire state. And the colors show something really neat about Minnesota. We are blessed with the natural systems that we have in our state, ranging from the blue area, think of those pine forests in the north, all the way down to the southwest and west of the state with the grasslands and prairies. It comes together in unique ways, and parks that are and trails of state significance are really designed to protect and conserve some of the gems of our natural and cultural systems. Legacy really makes it possible for us to enhance and accelerate the work to care for these most special places. As Renee mentioned, the strategic priorities, we really do focus on thinking about the infrastructure, the facilities, the opportunities, as well as getting people connected to them. The slide on the left is a fun example. Again, as Emmett mentioned, there's so many that we could choose from, but this is a nice one. It just highlights the interdependencies and coordinations across our system. Previously, the campground at Split Rock Lighthouse State Park really did not meet the capacity or demand. It just had some walk-in and cart-in campsites. It was a high-demand location. Legacy made it possible to really improve that campsite with more sites, electric sites, accessible sites, the kinds of things that people really want And on top of it, we were able to work with Lake County and the regional mountain biking system to ensure that people could go camp and then just take their bikes and ride to the regional mountain biking system. And so by working together, we connect up these systems because people don't care where they recreate. They just want to get outdoor and have some fun, as Renee said. Also, quick side note, it also connects up to the Gitche-Gami State Trail, which interestingly was recently named as a Reader's Choice for top 10 state trails or top 10 trails in the nation. So fun note. The slide picture on the right shows I Can program. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard of that program. Very popular way for beginners and other people who want to build their skills and start to feel more comfortable getting outside. So we have these incredible natural areas and features where people can go, but we need to provide opportunities for people to get to them. And I Can Camp is one way that we do that, along with I Can Paddle, I Can Climb, I Can Fish, and so on. So those are wonderful programs that bring in a variety. And then one more example, Sibley State Park's Lakeview Campground. This is a great example because much of the Parks and Trails system is a very mature system built 60 to 90 years ago. A lot of it was done in that CCC era. You'll see on the right picture way in the back is a CCC era, a shower building, which really needs to be upgraded in order to sustain over all these years. In addition, Legacy's provided great opportunities to put vault toilets around the state. And while that may sound like a small thing, it's actually a big deal because it allows people to get to the parks, stay there, and when the water's turned off, still have places to enjoy. And then my last slide, each of us in our system are demonstrating some of our coordinating efforts. So again, with this arts project, you'll see we've really had the opportunity to, again, try to connect people to the outdoors. We've had in the pilot places at Lake Bemidji State Park, Teteguch State Park, as well as Wild River State Park. These are a few pictures that show the art pack. On the left there, the artists work to make art packs for people and kids to get outdoors and find out new ways to explore nature. And then the middle and right slide, we had a wonderful, well-known artist at Teteguch State Park who got school kids into the parks, focused on art and nature. And so, again, we're looking to connect these facilities with people. And Legacy is really the game changer that's making it possible for us to do these things. Without Legacy, it wouldn't be possible for us to do these kinds of programs and efforts, as well as accelerate and enhance our ability to maintain a mature system in the state parks and trails. Thank you so much, and with that, I'll hand it back to Renee.
Thank you, Laura. So I'll get into our system. Our beautiful shot here is of Big Falls Campground and Horse Camp in Big Falls, population 175. That would not be possible, the improvements that have been made in their campground, were it not for about $2 million of legacy investments there. And think about it in context of a little community of 175 people who have been able to leverage no match, but a really great grant application two different times to upgrade their campground, which was very much needed, and build a pavilion there that serves not only the campers but their community. They now have a community gathering center. So legacy funds touch all areas of the state, and it's amazing what little communities can do with the willpower to create an application, first of all get designated, put in a funding application, and get great results that they would not have been able to get all on their own were it not for legacy investments across the state. So it's a remarkable opportunity that designated facilities have, large or small, to access these dollars. So this is our system. We serve the 80 counties that are not the 7-county metro area. Right now we have 84 designated facilities, and as we speak, we have a commission meeting happening in Marshall, Minnesota. I'll be attending virtually as soon as this is over. But I would anticipate by the time that meeting is done, there will be 85 designated facilities. We're reviewing one more application. But of those, we have 40 natural resource-based parks, 26 regional trails, 17 special features, and one supportive partnership. And then on deck are 17 designation-eligible facilities that are just waiting to submit a master plan. So one will drop off the 17 designation-eligible and turn into a designated facility today, I anticipate. So creating opportunities by connecting people to the outdoors is really an important pillar, and it's one that I have a lot of fun visiting. I'm from Duluth, so I'm based in Duluth, and both of these slides are actually from different programs that have happened in Duluth. The one on the left was a pretty creative grant application from the Duluth Traverse, which is a 100-mile-long mountain bike trail in the city of Duluth. It is designated. But they made an application for a mobile mountain bike fleet because their idea was to bring mountain biking instruction into communities that kids needed to have, that they didn't have access to. So they were going to teach kids how to ride mountain bikes. And with this mobile fleet, they could take it all across the city and go to where the kids were and work with programming in the schools and in the different areas that have kids in the summers. And what they found out was that kids were really excited to learn how to mountain bike, but a lot of these kids didn't have access to bikes. So what they were doing really was teaching them first how to ride a bike and then how to do mountain biking. And that program has been going on now for 3 summers, and they've had a lot of the same kids going, learning or continuing their education, actually doing this activity every summer. And it's been just so fun to go out and watch these kids who didn't have access to bikes to learn to ride, much less mountain bikes. So that program on its own is morphing into how can we find bikes for these kids so that we can continue for them to experience this activity that they've grown to really love. So out of a small grant grew this great opportunity for a lot of kids because things were brought into their areas, and now there's the whole push to let's get these kids bikes. So that's a really cool coordinating partners in the city of Duluth with a lot of different activities, but also certainly getting people connected to the outdoors. And then the photo on the right, these cute little kids, those are part of a school outreach program that happens at Hartley Nature Center in Duluth, which has gotten a grant in the past to expand their classroom space. They do a lot of before and after school activities, and particularly, of course, in the summer, they're very busy, but they had outgrown their facility because there was such a huge demand for it. So this is just some of the kids enjoying the activities that that particular facility has to offer. And so as we started talking about the MinPair, the Minnesota Parks Artisan Residence Program, that was a pilot program with all 3 partners. It was a lot of fun to do. It's unique, just a very different way of looking at things, and it was to create a sense of welcome and belonging for people that might not feel like they wanted to be in a park because it was something they're just not used to doing. So what would be a great way to introduce people that don't have an interest, maybe they don't think they do, at least in parks, but to bring an activity to them that they can participate in a park? And so it was wildly successful across all 3 systems, just lots of really interesting, unique, fun projects that were brought in by artists to create interest from the public over a series of months and decide what their art project was going to be in that particular park. So in the greater Minnesota system, while we had access, we could have done just 3 parks. We did end up doing 7 parks and almost killed this first artist we're looking at here because she had 3 parks she was doing programs in. Mural painting was one of them. She did several murals in different parks in the Rochester area. And so you can see the kids participating there, deciding what these projects are going to look like. And you see the project, the mural on the left is them starting off, and then you see the photo next to it, it's completed. It was really more of a paint by number. She came in and roughed it out and then got everyone painting where they needed to be. But you can see the results first with a lot of people participating, and second, this beautiful piece of art that they had at the end of it. This little kid I love, I saw him actually participating in a mosaic making activity at Douglas County Lake Brophy Park. And so the result was lots of workshops over the summer where kids got to come in and participate by making small mosaics that would eventually go around a larger mosaic tile. The picture on the right is a different mosaic that was done as part of this program in a different park, but this little boy was having so much fun that particular day learning how to do mosaics, and just he captured the spirit, I think, of what this project was just with his smile. And then finally, 2 parks had a real kind of a different outlook with their artist. She's a landscape architect who created these wonderful signs throughout 2 different park systems There's their botanical name, English name, Dakota name, and Ojibwe name for plants. But part of it was an app. So you would go up to these signs in the park, and you can see the QR code there, and you can learn more about the park, learn more about that plant, how it was used. And it's sort of a fun game. So at the end, if you've gone through the park and you've used this app, it builds a little creature for you at the end. But it was just a really fun way to connect kids, adults, let them learn things, and then an app, which I wouldn't think of, you know, as being particularly art, but it certainly was. It was great. Hit the point home. And then finally, these are all of our MinPair artists who participated over the last year. They look happy. They're having a great time, big smiles on their faces, and I think they perfectly represent the big smiles and fun that all of the participants in this project over the past year had. So they're a reflection of the fun that people had coming to work with them in our parks. So thank you very much for the opportunity today, and we can certainly answer any questions that you have. We appreciate being able to be here.
All right. Representative Pell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for coming out. My wife and kids and I were just up in the Duluth area and enjoyed some of those parks, and we appreciate the work that you've done up there. My city recently requested grant funding for a park through the LCCMR grant program, and it's for the Mississippi Dunes Park. It's on the Mississippi River. Cottage Grove is part of the area that I represent. Strangely, we have miles and miles of shoreline on the Mississippi, but really no access to the Mississippi for residents. And part of what this grant would do is it would help us continue to phase out within the master plan that already exists to build out an area for a boat launch and more access and a building, things of that nature. And I'm unsure if I believe you all are the right individuals to ask this question of, but I wanted to make sure, first of all, that there's awareness around that project. And then second, if there's anything else that I can do as a representative to try to continue to push for that, communicate with you all, and make sure that Grant stays top of mind and on the list. And wondered if you had any questions for me, too, about that project to make sure that occurs, and likely it would be useful for all the other representatives that might have that in their area, too. Thank you.
Who would like to answer that? Mr. Mullen?
Chair, Representative, I'd be happy to just say I will look into it. This is, I'm guessing, a local park that you're talking about, and it sounds like a great project, access to the Mississippi River, critical. Legacy funding is for state and regional parks, which are, you know, larger scale nature-based parks. That said, I can look into this and I will get back to you with information because I could put you in touch with the park director in the area.
Representative DeBell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe this is a regional park, and it's actually right next to some DNR land that was purchased also and kind of interconnects to a larger area. We have a couple different regional parks, as you're probably aware of, in Cottage Grove.
Yeah.
And, again, just wanted to make sure that that continues that process. Thank you. Thank
Laura, you, Madam Chair. Laura Price.
Chair, thank you. I would also say I'll look into that as well. You mentioned a boat launch, and we have a system of water recreation and public water accesses that we manage and oftentimes do work in partnership with communities. So likewise, I'll be happy to look into that. Thank you.
All right. Representative Pell.
That's all, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. Further questions? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming today. It's I think the parks and trails are a very popular part of the work that we do in this committee, and so thank you all for coming and being good stewards of these funds. I appreciate that you're trying to work together and trying to merge other activities such as arts, and I challenge our friends in Lasard Sands to do maybe a little better job of reaching into this other spaces. But there's my peck at the side for now. But I appreciate that you're trying to do that and get, you know, people out and work merging funds as best you can. And I'd be curious, like on the ICANN program, Ms. Price, if you could maybe tell us more about that and then how that offs, you know, how that works and how it's different than some of the other outdoor programs that are that we've added through the Environment Committee, and then maybe how many people are actually using that program, and if it's growing, or if, you know, what you're finding.
Laura Price.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the question about the ICANN program. There are many programs that try to connect people, and this is one of them, but we do believe it has a special and good niche. We've shown through many years that this program is one that invites people with little or no experience in the outdoors. It sort of comes with a mentor, someone who can help show a program about I Can Camp, for example. So people will sign up, pay a very small fee. All the equipment will be provided, and there will be a time where they'll be meeting at a state park to have an overnight or two nights. And then that sort of mentor and person will be there to help show them how to set up the tent, how to use the equipment. It gets started with cooking the meals. And so it's a way for people in a very low-cost sort of way, if they don't have the equipment, to be able to try it out and feel a little more comfortable with someone who knows the ropes, and then experience that and maybe the next time feel more comfortable going back again. So it's in state parks and recreation areas, so it exposes them to that system in a way that maybe other programs wouldn't. In addition, we see that it reaches a broader scope of people than we have in traditional other programs. We have excellent interpretive and naturalist programs, which are key and foundation to our system, but this one really focuses on trying to reach out to new people who maybe haven't been in the system. So we see a broader variety of demographics joining that system. And then also I'll just speak to the variety of the program. In addition to I Can Camp, there's I Can Paddle. So it's a great way. A lot of our parks have access to water. In fact, if you have a water body in a park, you can have free fishing for kids. And so there's boat accesses in parks, and people can get accustomed to canoeing or other types of activities that, again, they might not otherwise. I Can Fish, I Can Paddle, I Can Camp, I Can Mountain Bike. So it's been very popular. We see these programs fill up. And, in fact, if you go to our website, you'll be able to see the new round of this year's program offerings. I encourage you to share that with people. It's a great way for people to get connected. Thank you so much for the question.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. And it sounds like, you know, the greater Minnesota folks are, you know, doing that. You had the photo of the bikes and bringing the bikes, and I know the Met Council is doing that as well.
Absolutely.
So, and I think that's really important to get people out that necessarily don't have the equipment, like you mentioned, bicycles or kayaks. And kayak is such a great sport because it's really pretty affordable, mm-hmm. you know, to pick up a kayak and get on the water. Of course, you need to know how to do it safely. But I'd just be I'm this committee last year, we talked about trail quality. And I just quickly, if each of you could kind of tell it where you're at. I'm a little concerned, to be honest, with the DNR, because the busiest trail in the state of Minnesota, the Gateway right here, is pretty rough shape. But I'm just hoping that you're maintaining what you have. I was glad to see you're investing in bathrooms and other infrastructure. But maintaining the stuff we have is not only just building it, but maintaining it, make sure it's safe and usable for folks is really important. So just briefly, if that's all right, Madam Chair, to just kind of tell where each of you are at with your, you know, not only building new, but looking back and just making sure what we have is of good quality.
Yeah, proceed.
Chair, I'd be happy to start very briefly. Representative Lilly, what you ask about is so critical because it's really no fun to ride on a bumpy trail. Mm-hmm. And so when you commit to building a regional trail or state trail, you got to take care of it. And that's a big thing, especially as the numbers, like we're nearing 500 miles in our system. We are making strides with pavement management. Like, that's actually a field of study. And we've Three Rivers Park District is kind of out in front extending the life of their trails, which is once thought to be about 20 years, and really doubling it with when you do regular seal coating and just regular maintenance on the trails, you can really extend the life of it. So that's front of mind in the Metro Regional system, and I know it is in the other systems too.
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, yes, thank you for that question. I'll note in the DNR, earlier in the presentation, I noted that we have about 2,700 miles of designated trails, but only about 1,500 are developed. And really, it's to that very reason that we don't want to be, we can't be building out if we don't have funds to maintain and build all together at the same time. And so we really do try to maintain the trails that we have, but there's always going to be a backlog. As Emmett said, with the life cycle of pavement, over time, it does need to be renewed. And so legacy is the thing that really accelerates our ability to replace and enhance pavement, rehabilitate trails, repave trails. And it's an extremely important funding source for that. It's hard to keep up with this backlog. We could still have even more expenditures in that area. But we're trying to find that balance of keeping up pace as best we can, and legacy is really critical for that. We've emphasized a lot of programs, but infrastructure is basic, and a large amount of legacy goes towards taking care of what we have. I guess that's what I would note on that one. Thank you very much.
Renee?
Great. Thank you for the question. Before we designate a facility, we do ask how they plan to maintain and operate it. So before our trails are designated, they have to provide us with a plan that shows what their basic maintenance is going to be, because legacy, at least in our system, does not pay for crack sealing and seal coating. We expect that to be part of a regular maintenance plan. However, recognizing that the trails are generally free, there are two that do charge wheel passes. They get used. So one of the take care of what we have pillar is available for legacy funding to do brand new trail. Trails wear out. 20, 25 years, you've used up your trail. So we do have trails now that are applying for take care of what we have grants to rehabilitate and repave portions of those trails. In Representative Scraba's district, that would be the Mesabi Trail, an old system, 143 miles. Finally built out, but now it's needing, and Representative Hyensmith, yes,
yeah.
needs to be rehabilitated. So we do have grants available for that. And as far as the mountain bike systems, again, we expect that to be regular maintenance. But there are times when sections of trails need to be redone because sometimes it's maybe not a good section. So we do have grants available for that as well. But again, before something's designated, we want to know what your maintenance and operation plan is so that you can take care of that trail to the best of your ability before you have to do major reconstruction of it.
All right. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the update. And maybe you can provide it afterwards. I'd be curious how you're doing with some of the mobility devices that are at your systems. So maybe you could send that to members, and because that, I think, is really popular. And I know you're trying to do it, but I've seen it in some of the parks that we've been to on bonding, and mm-hmm. I think some are legacy, some aren't. And anyways, just like an update if we could. Thank you.
All right. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chair. Funny you should ask about maintaining and getting money is available. Representative Shaw and myself are on House File 4265 to appropriate $4 million through capital investments for the greater Minnesota parks and trails. We're trying to get money through the DNR to help all of this. It's to the commissioner. We'll be able to use that money for communities that need help on this. So it's trails, obviously. I'm a trail person, snowmobile, ATV, hiking, biking. I don't care what trail it is. I'll support it just because that's why we live here, in my opinion. I want to thank you guys for all the work. Obviously, I was giving these guys a hard time. That's my district. yeah. but it is pretty impressive when you look around how many, what, and you know, I do, he's not here, but one of the members over there, he's real critical of our trails in greater Minnesota because he wants to get the trails, Rick, He's always like, you know, Mesabi Trail doesn't need any more money. We need to get the money down here. And I'm like, great, but your people come up to my district to use the trails, and we have to maintain this. So it's kind of a mutual benefit. The state dollars that are used get to maintain or build trails, and then our counties and our cities and our people maintain it, and we keep it going. And Wheel Pass and Mesabi, that helps maintain it. But it's you can't keep up with Balm of Gilead. You know, it is a route that just wrecks everything in the woods. And as much as you try, you can't. And it costs money to repair that. It's yeah. not cheap. So, you know, any help we can get on that maintenance, we always will. But I have a question for the Blakely Bluffs Park Reserve acquisition. How many acres is that acquisition or transition or?
Yeah, Chair, Representative Scraba, Blakely Bluffs, I think the full extent is around 2,500 acres. This is from my memory, so dangerous place. But I think that they've put together a little less than half of that, so okay. like probably like over 1,000 acres. And they need to get a critical mass together before they can open it. They're going to open it, I think, before the whole park has been acquired. Mm-hmm. But there's area, particularly in the northern part of it, that they're blocking up first. And they are working very closely with the landowners in that area, who are currently mostly farmers, to on a willing seller basis to get that done. And so it's going to take a few more years to open it. But it's a really exciting park. I went out there in the middle of the summer last year and walked around with the park manager, Patty Freeman. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful, you know, place. And it's actually amazing because it's connected to Greater Minnesota, to the west. The trail will eventually, I think it does go, I think it's Henderson. That's my memory. Mm-hmm. And then it goes all the way up to, Fort Snelling State Park. So it's, you know, is it all there? Not quite, but it almost is.
Chair. Representative Scraba.
Thank you. Was it always a park down there? I'm not familiar with it. So it was, and it's
no.
just adding, or is this all brand new? Or?
It's a new park reserve, yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if there was a local park that started it, but it's a new area.
Okay. All right.
Representative Scraba.
That's it. Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thanks.
Representative Cha.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you all for being here. You know, when I was younger, my parents took me down to the lower Mississippi, and we foraged for mushrooms. Oh. Can I have you guys touch on foraging in these parks and stuff and, you know, give us an update about that?
Mm-hmm. Renee Mattson.
Thank you for the question. It's available. Foraging is open to folks in our parks in Greater Minnesota. Not commercial harvesting, but certainly personal foraging is available to those people who want to do that activity.
Representative Cha.
Yeah, I think it's just an important hobby, you know, of families, especially immigrant communities, because that's how we are connected to the parks and, you know, the forests and the land. And so, you know, I always look forward to improving foraging in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Amit Mullen.
I was just going to reinforce what Renee and Laura would say, I think, is that we're working on this. We know there's work to be done, and we think it is a really important thing to open up to these opportunities. So.
Okay. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad that we're having a conversation about maintaining what we have. Representative Lilly always knows that there's going to be a robust conversation when that comes up because, of course, it's very challenging to keep trails in tip-top shape or open at all. And I'm going to cite some numbers that were just brought to me a couple of days ago. Seal coating per mile, $50,000 to $58,000. Repaving, $150 to $170 a foot, which comes out between $700 and $800 plus thousand dollars a mile. We have thousands of miles of paved trail in Minnesota. I have the Paul Bunyan, as we just were joking about a few moments ago. It's over 30 years old. You do the math on that, 115 to 119 miles. When that needs to be redone, where are we going to find $100 million? And while we have at least now, as of last year, and now we're going to have the opportunity to access community grant program dollars for fixing what we have, it's never going to be enough. And we are reaching a tipping point. There's just not enough money to take care of what we have, and it's not sexy to put a new roof on a building or seal coat a trail or crack seal a trail. Members, we don't talk enough about this. So I really appreciate, Representative Lilly, that you brought that up today. And I hope going forward enough of us are pushing this issue and we can work towards a solution, because there will never be enough bonding money. Never. No. Just won't. We're backlogged, I believe, in the neighborhood of $350 million, if I remember a conversation with DNR last year, in deferred maintenance. It's probably way more than that. That was just on trails. I think we referred to our memories as what was the exact word? I won't ask the testifier to recall, but it's challenging. A lot there to unpack with taking care of state-owned assets. And the question is going to be continually going forward, if we're buying more, how are we going to take care of it, manage it so that it's available for public use? We love to see new access for campsites and campers, and we love to see new trails, but if we don't take care of it, what's the point?
All right. Any further questions or remarks from the committee? All right. Well, thank you so much for being here today. I am very excited for the summer, seeing all the activities that's happening. So thank you so much for all the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Next on the agenda, we have an update from the Clean Water Fund. This is our last agenda item for the day. And Jen Cater, if you can make your way to the table from the Clean Water Council. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
All right. Good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jen Cater, and I'm the administrator for Minnesota's Clean Water Council. And while I'm the one that's sitting up here at the table, I do want to acknowledge that over in the wings, we have several representatives from our state agencies that are here to help answer any specific questions you might have for the individual agencies or for some of the individual programs. But otherwise, I'll be running us through a presentation over the course of the next 15 minutes or so. My predecessor, Paul Gardner, presented to this committee last year, and so a lot of this might be familiar to all of you, but we've also been up to quite a lot over the course of the last year, so there's a lot of new information that I'd like to share with you as well. The first big update is there's a new face up here. So I did mention my predecessor, Paul Gardner. He retired from state service in June, and I had the immense honor of being hired as the new administrator starting last May. And so while I'm new to this role, I also want to note that I'm not new to the council. I have been engaged and involved with the Clean Water Council in one way, shape, or form since 2017, so close to a decade, including having served as an statewide environmental organization representative and vice chair. And across those roles and across those years, I have really gotten to know a lot of the programs that the council funds and supports firsthand, and I've been able to see the the impact and outcomes of that work across the state. And it's one of the big reasons why I was thrilled to be able to be a part of this in this role, is because I care so much about these funds and the work that it is able to produce across the state. But that is enough about me. I'm going to pivot over to the rest of the presentation. I've got several things that I want to try to get in over the course of the next 15 minutes, and I've given a version of this talk that has lasted 3 hours with interactive components. I am not doing that one today, but there might be points where I may have broadened too far, so I do welcome any questions you might have as we get to the end of the presentation, too. So I will be touching first on some Clean Water Council and fund basics. Again, I know you are all very familiar with this, but just for anyone who may be watching online or more new to the conversation, want to touch on some of the background details, and then jump into just talking a little bit about our investment approach that we use, and then share a little bit about some of the things that we've done over the last year, just to provide some quick updates, and then just a quick note on what it is that we are up to right now. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and just jump right into the council fund and basics. And first thing that I want to talk about is the Clean Water Council itself. This was created prior to the prior to the legacy amendments in 2006, and really came out of a response to a report that came from the Office of the Legislative Auditor in 2002 that was underscoring just the challenge that Minnesota faced in addressing impaired waters. There was a stakeholder group that was pulled together in response to this to take a look at the extent of the degree to which there was significant underfunding for Minnesota being able to address water challenges across the state. And that stakeholder group also came together and acknowledged and included in their reports their concerns regarding the potential for lawsuits, the potential for significant impacts to economic development, and taking a look at just the impact that delays could also have just on activities in the state of Minnesota. And one of the things that they recommended was the creation of a Clean Water Council that could work to set up a systematic approach to being able to tackle Minnesota's impaired waters challenge and establish a council that could also help support coordination and collaboration among the agencies and with the local communities that are critical and essential in being able to allow for the impact that has taken place to date. They, in setting up the council, identified as 28 members, 17 of whom are appointed by the governor and represent a variety of different perspectives that can be the environmental organizations, counties, cities, businesses, farmers, and others. There are also 11 non-voting members, including four legislators and seven who are representing agencies, the Metropolitan Council, and the University of Minnesota. Together, they advise the governor and the legislature on the implementation of the Clean Water Legacy Act. So that's that 2006 act that created the council, and strengthening that coordination and collaboration, really focusing in on helping to enhance statewide capacity to tackle these issues and establishing a systematic and programmatic approach that can make progress on addressing those water challenges. And more than just, you know, that responsive piece of it, of acknowledging that there was a challenge in place, the report and the hope for the council would also be that it would be able to really produce those durable outcomes for water across the state of Minnesota. And so it had a solid policy framework and set up, but there was not a funding mechanism that had been identified to go with it. But they still wanted to put it forward, acknowledging that that coordination and setting up the systematic approach would be beneficial even without the funding mechanism to go with it. But enter 2008 with the legacy amendments, where that 3/8% dedicated sales tax was established. A third of that goes to the Clean Water Fund. Approximately $300 to $330 million right now for what it's producing for the biennium. But by the time that we are reaching the current expiration of 2034, it would be expected to produce about $3 billion. $300 billion would be fantastic, but that's a huge tax load. So $3 billion to be spent by the time it expires in 2034. The council was given a role in recommending how to use that to the legislature and to the governor. The amendment to language itself says that it may only be spent to protect, enhance, and restore water quality in lakes, rivers, and streams, protect groundwater from degradation, and protect drinking water sources. And in fact, at least 5% of it must be used to protect drinking water sources. And I can say with certainty that looking at the analysis that we are well north of that 5% mark. And a lot of the work that we do with multiple benefits has both direct and indirect benefits for drinking water as well. I could go through a long story and lots of projects and examples, but I did just want to put this up here. Feel free to take a look at it at your own leisure. We did put together in trying to help tell the story of the impact that the Clean Water Funds have had on the states. Worked with a consulting firm to put up a communications tool that is showing how the Clean Water Fund has been used to protect, enhance, and restore surface waters, groundwater, and drinking water across the states. So feel free to take a look at it. It's a story map as well as some fact sheets that are available for your use later. But what I would hope you would see there, as well as in the remainder of the presentation, is the way that the Clean Water Fund really has enabled the protection of our pristine waters. It has helped to restore our degraded waters and even removing waters from the impaired waters list, and is protecting our groundwater and drinking water sources. And the way that the Clean Water Fund has enhanced our water programs, and our Parks and Trails funds mentioned accelerating, then the value that the Legacy Fund has had for accelerating work. It's accelerating work here as well in meeting our progress, or accelerating our progress in meeting clean water goals. And kind of underscore it, the Clean Water Funds, if you just want to take one thing away from this, has improved water quality efforts that were way beyond the state's existing capacity in 2008. It has been called a game changer in surveys that we've done of folks across the states and folks who have looked at the fact that we're able to do things now that were hardly even dreams back when this was first being created. So good work was happening. I do want to acknowledge that. Things didn't start with the Clean Water Act, or the Clean Water Legacy Act and the Clean Water Amendments, but it just was, it paled in comparison to the scale of the challenge, and we were acting in a lot of ways without some of the information that we now have the benefit of being able to use. So with that, I want to jump into how it is that we invest, or how it is that we recommend the investments of these dollars. One of the things that the Clean Water Council and state agencies really focused on in the early days was helping to adopt and hone a theory of change that would be able to say how it is that logically and systematically we could ensure that the funds that we are being, that are being used are helping to lead to the clean water outcomes that everyone wants to see. And what they pulled together was based on an adaptive management framework. So this is that plan, do, check, adapt sort of approach. But we've added it with the fifth bucket to just kind of show how it is that all these different programs relate to each other and help to build on the outcomes that each of the other investments are producing. So if you want to take a look, starting over on that blue section with monitoring, assessment, and characterization, this is where we get to look. Then we move into seeking to understand and to understand where things are coming from, develop strategies in that green bucket that are responding to that applied research and problem investigation. We're taking those strategies and putting them into a comprehensive plan that prioritizes them, and then funding the plan and the work that is in it to be able to see changes on the landscape, going back and monitoring, continuing with that research, et cetera, continuing to adapt and move around. So with our water management framework, I'm going to jump in a little bit more detail with each step along the way. The first one then with that monitoring, assessment, and characterization, we have such a benefit in this state of being able to understand the current conditions across the state. We understand more about what's happening with our waters because we've looked for more things, we've looked in more places, and often at a scale that is more reflective of the potential for public health and economic risk or ecological risk. We have, you know, a large impaired waters list that is a result of a lot of those monitorings because we monitored and we tested and we found out that we have those impaired waters. But now with that knowledge in hand, we can do something with that. The first 10-year cycle of lakes and streams for looking at monitoring and assessing across the entire state was completed in 2017. So we are well underway with the second cycle. And one of the things that we have the opportunity now to see, based again on that adaptive management cycle, is we're looking back and we're seeing some of the changes that have taken place from that first round, from the first round of monitoring that was done. We've also been able to increase our groundwater modeling and monitoring, and when we find things that need a little bit more of a deep dive, we can invest in monitoring and modeling for specific challenges and risks that emerge. But this is a far cry. I just want to kind of put this up here again. I've referenced that 2002 Office of the Legislative Auditor report that was noting the significant underfunding. We've now completed a 10-year cycle for the entire state, are working on that second 10-year cycle. And in 2002, the report notes that we had only fully assessed 5% of the state's stream miles and 12% of the state's lakes. So again, in terms of knowing more about our waters and being able to use that information to develop science-based approaches to being able to improve waters and protect those that are still in good shape, it's a big change from where we had been. The next step in that cycle is that problem investigation and applied research. Again, this is where we get to take a look at the information that the monitoring and assessment was showing us to be able to say, okay, what are the problems, where are they coming from, and what is needed to be able to do something about it. This lets us focus in on research then that helps us to address those challenges as well as look at the opportunities that might be in front of us to be able to make changes on the landscape. So this is where we get to develop some of those future solutions or start to explore what might be needed for information that we don't have yet. So there's just a handful of programs that are listed on here. I also want to acknowledge there was a handout included that on the backside has a list of a sampling of programs across each of these steps. Feel free to take a look at that, too, as we continue through the presentation. But based then on having this additional information of understanding the issues and the opportunities, we can then develop strategies that take that information into account and help to pave the way forward for making changes that can improve waters across the states. And again, we had that statewide approach for monitoring. We also have a statewide approach for being able to provide these strategies. And we know that one size does not fit all. Different geographies, different geologies, different communities require different approaches to being able to make a difference. We can start with some of the basics, but then being able to adjust it to make it more specific to the needs of each watershed is an important step. And with the watershed restoration and protection strategies, affectionately known as RAPS, and then the groundwater restoration and protection strategies and GRAPS, those two sets of documents together really help provide a menu for local communities in being able to choose how it is that they want to try and tackle their own impaired waters challenges, restore waters, protect waters, and make a difference for drinking water across the state. The next step in the process is that comprehensive watershed management plan. This is where we get to take all that monitoring and research, take all those strategies that were developed, and mix them with local priorities and values. And that gets produced into a prioritized, targeted, and measurable plan that has 10-year goals established in it and a understanding of the strategies that these watershed groups and partnerships want to use and a prioritized schedule for how they want to pursue it and a cost that says this is how much it's going to cost to be able to achieve this. So they've pulled all that information together on a watershed scale rather than county boundaries, acknowledging that water doesn't stop at county borders, and so there's an opportunity to establish partnerships that really take into account the entire length of the water systems. I am a planner by trade. That's what I got my master's in, and I will talk about plans all day, but plans that sit on a shelf do nobody any good. Plans that get used have the opportunity to make a difference. And so that's one of the things that the council also focuses on is that next step of moving into implementation. So the Clean Water Fund, more than two-thirds of the funding that we receive goes to implementation. And that's a lot of work that I just talked about in the previous slides, and that was just a sampling of some of that content. Yet we still have over two-thirds of the funding going to projects on the ground. In addition to the stuff that we fund directly through the Clean Water Fund, there are projects that receive funding from other funding sources that use the information that is produced through the monitoring, through the RAPS and GRAPS, and even through the partnerships that are established. And so we know that there's additional things that are benefiting from the work of the Clean Water Fund beyond what we're directly funding as far as projects and implementation on the ground. And every dollar that the Clean Water Fund is spent on implementation leverages more than a dollar of other funding sources. And we're seeing that many of these investments are also producing multiple benefits as well. This work is happening across the state. This is not all of the work that we do. It's just a sampling. The green dots are communities that received source water protection grants from the Minnesota Department of Health. Those reddish-brownish dots, those are farms that have been enrolled in the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program. And those bluish-teal dots are programs and projects that have been funded through the Board of Water and Soil Resources for implementation work, too. And you can see the way that it is spread across the state in helping to for the actual projects on the ground. And I do want to have you harken back to those other maps that showed the impact of planning across the states, those developmental strategies across the state that are also out there and available. It is also more than dots on a map. We, with the Clean Water Fund, are investing in programs that seek to increase awareness and understanding of the threats and opportunities. This is at the individual level, the community level, working with decision makers across the state, just focusing on really helping to build that understanding of the challenges and opportunities that are ahead of us. We are building partnerships that are transcending the work of the Clean Water Fund. I mentioned that with the One Watershed, One Plan program that has now has partnerships across the state. These are programs that are bringing together people who have maybe not worked together. We were up in the Upper Mississippi River headwaters just this past fall, where we had folks from representing soil and water conservation districts and counties sitting up at the front of the table telling us how historically they never had a reason to really work together. They had a large workload and lots of things that were on their plates, and something that was happening at one end of the river work that was taking place is separate from the involvement of folks who maybe were at the other end of the river. And now they're working together and having conversations about what it is that they want to work on together. And in that process, they're learning what each other is up to and saying, hey, you've got a fantastic approach for reaching landowners and community members, and we want to be able to copy that. And so now they're able to learn from each other, have that peer development and learning opportunity, and use that the benefit of those partnerships in ways that are beyond just what we're funding with the Clean Water Fund. We are seeing a delisting of water bodies. The handout notes, I think, 87, but as of September, we have 95 that have been delisted. And I want to acknowledge it can take one test to be able to show that something is impaired, and it can take 20 years of work to be able to get it off the impaired waters list. But having a targeted information and strategies that have been prioritized to be able to invest in addressing some of these challenges, we are excited to see, now that the train has left the station, what all this work and coordination is going to be able to produce over even just the next 8 years. In addition to that restoration work, we are investing in permanent protection, acknowledging that protection is an awful lot cheaper than restoration, and that we have all these fantastic waters across the state that are in pristine condition or are nearly impaired, and there's an opportunity to focus work there to keep them in great shape and off that impaired waters list. I mentioned earlier that we're in that second cycle of monitoring and being able to see the differences from one cycle to the other. And there was a fantastic report that was produced by the Pollution Control Agency this last summer that was called the Flowing Forward Report. And within that, it was showing that we have seen statistically significant improvements in ecological conditions of Minnesota's rivers and streams. We also had the update to the nutrient reduction strategy that came out even just this past January that was noting that phosphorus conditions in Minnesota's larger rivers are generally decreasing or staying the same. These are hard trend lines to move, and we're seeing them budge, which is exciting to have that as an outcome of all this work. We are also reducing excess water use across the state, whether that's through more efficient appliances or working with farmers and irrigators on systems that they have as well to help them meet their own goals as farmers. And we are leading the way on PFAS, chloride, more. There's so much more that I could include in here, and I'm happy to discuss this in more detail coming up. But I also want to make sure that we have a moment to talk about some of the things that we've been up to lately, as well as what it is that we are up to right now. We've produced in the last year a couple of new key documents for the council just internally so that you understand how it is that we're working and approaching this work. We passed in early summer a new public participation plan. It's the first one that we've had that really is outlining the commitment that the council has to public engagement and participation. It is clarifying the opportunities for constituents, stakeholders, interested parties to be able to provide input to the council at times and in ways that are going to be able to maximize its influence and their input into the discussions. And we're equipping council members with the tools and resources that can help them engage their own constituencies so that as they're sitting at their table representing lakes and streams organizations or farmers, they're bringing with them the input from folks that are within that same constituent group into the conversations that we're having. We also developed, largely in response to the feedback and the input that we received from folks over the years, a scoring rubric or an evaluation rubric and proposal form revisions that are taking into account just the need for us to be able to show what the values are and the priorities of the council, making sure that we're increasing transparency, consistency of our approaches in reviewing applications, and the accountability of the council to the people of Minnesota. We're also through this process, ensuring that we're increasing and enhancing that understanding of programs, both on the council as well as with the people that we work with that are not on the council. In addition to these two more internal documents, and I mentioned a couple of these already, we've in the last year also had a handful of significant program outputs and milestones that I just wanted to share with you so that you had this information in front of you. We did, through the Clean Water Fund, supports Minnesota's first statewide drinking water action plan. That's taking a look at making sure that we have that thoughtful, systematic approach to addressing drinking water across the state and acknowledging that it's not any one agency's role. It's work that we all do together. I mentioned the Flowing Forward report as well as the nutrient reduction strategies. And so, of course, with every meeting that we have with the council, we're digging into strategies and topics of pressing concern. And so are often digging into things that don't necessarily fit into a nice report for sharing out, but are part of the considerations that we have as a body. I also want to note, coming up yet this spring, we will have the next Clean Water Fund performance report. That's a great opportunity to take a look at the information in there regarding what the funds are producing in terms of those changing trend lines and outputs that we are also focused on as a council. And what we are up to right now, this is my last content slide, we are currently reviewing proposals for the FY28-29 biennium. The forecast included $330 million for the next biennium. Of course, we're also taking a look at what that's going to look like in the November forecast, but we are reviewing all of those proposals to figure out how we want to best invest Clean Water Fund dollars for the next biennium. In addition to those budgetary considerations and recommendations we're developing, we are preparing policy statements regarding a handful of really pressing topics that we've heard from our from stakeholders and interested parties that they want us to be focusing on and taking a look at. And there are a number of other policy statements that we also want to dig into as time allows, but these are the ones that we are currently taking a look at for our next policy or our next recommendations report that is going to be coming out in January of 27. And with that, I will go ahead and turn it back over for questions.
Thank you. Representative Dippel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question on the Clean Water Fund about at least 5% needing to be used for clean water and the sources therein. I had spoken with Commissioner Mirren, who I believe sits on the council as well, and got three different letters of support over to him from different individuals in Dakota County, both the City of Hastings, large organizations, and commissioners from Dakota County. And within that, there are a couple different asks, but one of them is Mr. Kadelka had acknowledged from the 3M settlement money that one of the wells had been contaminated with PFAS from the Chemelite plant, which is just north of Hastings on the Mississippi River, and I acknowledge rivers are very difficult to control and deal with, having lived on the Mississippi nearly my entire life. However, the PFAS was found to have made its way down into the ground, passed through likely some cracks in the bedrock, and infiltrated some water systems. And so I'm trying to understand how this money could be used in an ideal, viable, and way that is laid out within the parameters of the clean water side of things. And so one item or one question that I have for you would be, can this water be used to mitigate that particular source of PFAS so it doesn't continue to pollute those drinking water supplies? Because, and I'll just add a caveat, I understand that, and it's been reiterated many times, that that money isn't supposed to be used to build water filtration systems, for instance. And so that would be the first part of my question. And then second part would be, for instance, since the drinking water source is contaminated and people use sprinklers and hoses and they're spraying the water all over the place in their yards, it goes back down into the drainage and right back into the river where it may not have even been initially, but we're pumping it out of these aquifers that have been contaminated. And I'd like to know how that logically connects also, because not only would these filtration systems prevent people from drinking PFAS, which of course we don't want, but it would also mitigate the future continual pollution of other bodies of water around and the ground around people's homes, et cetera. Does that make sense? Is that?
It does to some extent. And I'm going to look over to my agency partners. I mentioned that I am here at the table, but I have a number of folks who are in the room. And so I'm looking at Glenn for the PFAS conversation, as well as Tanny. So Glenn Scuda with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And to Tanny, would you want to take on some of the source water questions regarding PFAS and water use?
Welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Glenn Scuda, the Watershed Division Director with the Pollution Control Agency. To the question and representative, yeah, very good questions. Big policy questions there of you alluded to sort of appropriate use of the funds. There's some questions about what is or is not actual legal or appropriate use that have been talked about in the past. Beyond legalities, just the how do we want to use the funds, I guess, what's appropriate, that I think are big policy questions that would need to be vetted by more people than just me, obviously. I think there's a polluter pays concept that has gone into a lot of the sort of Superfund remediation work over the years. These are typically really large dollar projects that would could really overtax literally the fund and not enable other work to happen if we started to put a lot of clean water fund money into groundwater remediation type projects. So excellent questions, but very big policy questions.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, one of the principles of the Clean Water Fund guided, given to us in statute, is that we cannot supplant pre-existing activities, but we can use it to supplement. So much of our work on drinking water protection in the East Metro and the PFAS situation there began in the early 2000s, and so it predates the existence of the Clean Water Fund. And we have extensive collaboration with our colleagues at PCA, addressing PFAS in the East Metro, both in public water systems, those community water systems, as well as the numerous private wells that have been contaminated in that area. Where we have been able to take advantage of the Clean Water Fund is in the area of addressing contaminants of emerging concern like PFAS. In the previous years, we didn't have the ability to develop health guidance values unless a contaminant was detected in our groundwater. And for someone with a public health approach to develop that value after we found it is contrary to the way we work. We want to be able to look at what chemicals are being used in Minnesota and in advance of finding them know what the health consequences of those contaminants are. So we have contaminants of emerging concern program. We've also been able to use Clean Water Fund dollars to evaluate PFAS concentrations in fish. Recently, this week, we had a news release about our recent findings on PFAS in fish and advising people on ways that they can safely consume fish to have the benefits without the exposure to the contaminants. Another way that we've used Clean Water Fund is to do a statewide evaluation of PFAS in other areas of the state. And so we've been able to sample every community water system for a suite of PFAS chemicals to be able to determine where are they in the state and where's the next place that we're going to do risk mitigation.
Representative Dipple.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess just to be really specific, and I appreciate that information, that's all very helpful. I'm wondering if the Clean Water Fund has supplemented, not supplanted, but supplemented any of the activities to try to mitigate future and further pollution of both Hastings, Cottage Grove, since 3M is in that area that you cited the metro is heavily affected. Has the Clean Water Fund entered into and helped mitigate any of those and come alongside those projects? Thank you.
Proceed.
Madam Chair, and I realize I didn't even introduce myself. I was so eager to tell you about what the Clean Water Fund has done. So my name is Tani Eschnauer, and I manage the Water Policy Center at the Minnesota Department of Health. So, yes, one of the things that we're learning about people's exposure to perfluorochemicals is that while we've been addressing the exposures through drinking water, the larger exposure is now coming through our consumer products. And so we've been able to use Clean Water Fund dollars, again, in collaboration with the Pollution Control Agency to alert people to make better choices about their consumer products. And so looking at, for example, fabrics that are used in our homes or carpets, those kinds of consumer products that are treated with PFAS and also become an exposure pathway so that people are inhaling things like dust. And so that's a major prevention strategy now. Can we use less of those products in our consumer habits?
Representative Dipple.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry to sound redundant and like a broken record here, but just very specifically, has the Clean Water Fund come alongside of any of the projects that exist right now on the east side of the metro to help clean up, mitigate, and make sure the drinking water does not continue to be polluted?
Yeah. Jen Cater.
Madam Chair, Representative, I want to be able to look into that and give you a more specific answer. I can say that the Metropolitan Council, through their water sustainability program, has been doing a planning with water suppliers in the metro area, specifically asking them about the needs and the challenges as it relates to PFAS, and to trying to figure out what sort of next steps or actions might make sense. And so I know there's been discussion in helping to support the suppliers in kind of working together around some of those solutions. But I know that there's that fine line that gets into infrastructure and to treatment and things along those lines that we're carefully walking. But I can take a look and get more specifics into that information, even if the specific answer is we haven't supplemented this part of it, but there has been work that we've done around PFAS at a grander scale.
Okay. Representative Dipple.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's all. I appreciate the testifiers and all the information, even the extra information. Thank you.
All right. Representative Heintzman.
Representative DePell's question and the fine line you were just mentioning. Could you, for the benefit of the committee today and for those like 14 people watching at home, help us better understand that fine line? Because I think there is a desire from a lot of folks, and I did serve on the Clean Water Council for quite some time, and I see that our chair is here today also, so welcome in the audience. What are the constitutional and policy guidelines that have led to quote-unquote creation of a fine line? There would, I think, be a desire amongst a lot of folks in the public to see more collaboration on projects like Representative DePell was just mentioning. And if we need to bring some more folks up to the testifier's desk, that'd be just fine.
Okay. Jen Cater.
All right. Madam Chair, Representative Heitzman. If anybody wants to come up and join me, they are welcome to self-elect. But I will note that even just in the last couple of years, especially in response to the EPA direction to do more about private wells in southeast Minnesota, there was investigation. The council expressed interest in being able to figure out the best way for the council and the fund to be able to support work even at the private well level, as well as thinking about community and public systems. And at the time, the response that we got from the nonpartisan staff was that we needed to be focused on sources, so the sources that lead to the drinking water versus treatments or infrastructure to be able to treat the water. And so it's been recently reinforced, but we do hear this often, that especially from private wells where there is a gap in the governance system to be able to support private well users, and then things like more significant contaminants of emerging concern that have a significant cost associated. In the discussions that we've had historically around this topic, one of the things that we touched on was something like an infrastructure budget would really zap the available funding in the Clean Water Fund pretty quickly. And so that's one of the sort of safeguards there, is to ensure that there's that funding available for other uses. I'm happy to record this and hang on to the information. I don't know if anybody has anything else that they want to share. So,
Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Heitzman.
We have nonpartisan staff here today with us. If they could maybe walk us through what is a constitutional line for infrastructure projects and what might be a policy at the Clean Water Council that could help. And if we do need to have information provided at a later time, that's fine also.
Okay. I think Janelle, you'll take that question.
Madam Chair and members, I think what she was referring to was a Senate Council opinion on a particular proposal. I would not venture to say whether something is constitutional or not. I would just caution the committee that the Constitution requires that the activities protect, enhance, restore water quality in lakes, rivers, and streams, and protect groundwater from degradation and protect drinking water sources. So to the extent that the activity would meet those, there's no case law. It's up to the committee.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. And I also have looked at the constitutional language, and I see it in the same way as it was just read. And while we have, say, for example, in the renewal of the ENRTF, very specific language now limiting those dollars from being used to clean water, for example, wastewater, I don't think that that exists for the Clean Water Council in terms of the project selection they're constitutionally bound to. And while it may be somewhat of a controversial conversation, I think that Representative DePelle's example is a really good one, that this is something that we should see more from the Clean Water Council. And I hope that, as opposed to maybe the focus so, or as mentioned earlier, trying to drive consumer decisions, and that's just probably a very small piece of some of the projects that have been funded, we would like to see more boots on the ground, collaboration with communities to actually clean water. Mm-hmm. And since Chair Barton is here with us today, hopefully that's heard. And there'll be some things coming down the road. I will just conclude, Madam Chair, by saying that I think today's presentation was very well, and I congratulate the council for selecting a excellent messenger. Your administrator hardly even had to look at the notes. So very good job.
Stopped on page 3.
All right, members, we have about 3 more members with questions. Representative Cha.
Thank you. I share the same concern as my colleague DePelle over there. I just want to highlight that, you know, in Woodbury, of the 20 wells, 9 of those are contaminated. 6 are being treated. You know, we have in Woodbury, the city of Woodbury, about 84,000 people. You know, Woodbury is investing to a $340 million water treatment facility plant. We're replacing 17 miles of pipeline in Woodbury. I moved into Woodbury in 2006. The issue wasn't discovered until 2016. That means me and my children have been drinking water from our tap, making bottles for my children for that many years. It's a great concern. You know, we all deserve clean water. And, you know, I want to thank the council and continue work. And, but it looks like we still have more work to do.
and as you can see from the conversations of the committee, but also with the chloride and the chlorine that's coming down our watershed, those are concerns to all of us here too. But thank you for being here, and congrats on the job. Thank you.
Representative McDonough.
Madam Chair, my question is not as important as the PFAS issue, but I will reiterate some of that. I think that this was sold in 2008 as clean water, and I think most Minnesotans believe that it would be, of course, downstream, rivers, waters, streams, lakes, but also the water that we put into our bodies, which is even just as important as downstream. So I think going forward, if I'm on this committee, if I get elected again next year, no, this year, and serve on legacy, I think, and any other committee members, I'm sure Lily will be here, that we need to push that the clean water also works in tandem with our local jurisdictions for clean water, the water that we put into our bodies that give us life. And I think there's a disconnect there, at least what I've determined here in the last couple of years. So that's my piece on that. Question for you, Ms. Kadar, regarding the website that you alluded to, which was very good. I went to the website. It's a new website. Clean Water Fund has their own website. This is a new one. And you said you had contacted an outside firm to put this put together for you. Again, it's not as important as the first question regarding the water that we put into our bodies. But what's the cost of that outside firm that put this together for you? And did that include the website that we're looking at? Or if you go to, if you scan your QR code, you can go to that. So wonder on the cost of that.
Jen Kadar.
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, I don't have that information in front of me. That was something that was before my time, but it's something I can go back and find and follow up with you with more information later.
Chair McDonald.
Thank you. And I'm not micromanaging the Clean Water Fund by any means, but it's an expensive website, I know. Whenever you have an outside firm using taxpayer dollars, boy, the costs go up exponentially. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's taxpayer dollars. I'm a private firm. Boy, they got money. So I think we, as a committee, should know that cost. It could be nothing or minimal, but it could be something that might blow the water off our socks. Is that a saying? Anyway, it is now. So I think we should know that. I don't have any doubt that under the old administration with Paul Gardner that, and with John Barton here, who's from the great city of Delano, that they've been very fiscally responsible with our dollars. I know they have. I want to know that.
And
Jen Kadar.
Just very quickly, I can tell you, I know that there's that conversation constantly on the council of how do we use limited administrative dollars to be able to help stretch the impact as far as it can go. With the council's requirements to be able to also communicate out about the outcomes of the work and the work that we're doing, that's one of the things that we're taking a look at going forward. And we're trying to, you know, use the funding that we have as wisely as possible and being able to fulfill those requirements.
Chair McDonald.
Very wisely said, Ms. Kadar. And just to let you know, last week the DNR was in front of us, and they were on the hot seat for buttons, bumper stickers, T-shirts, and some laptops. So these are big issues.
Okay. Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming. So just a little self-disclosure. I still have... I still struggle to figure out like the money that goes to you guys through clean water. And then I also serve on bonding with some other people on the committee here too. But I always, all the pots I have, I sometimes struggle. So I just hope your group can continue to do a good job of separating, you know, which funds are being used where, and just, you know, some of the things I've seen that I really like is that you're doing is like working, for example, which I never expected as a Metro member, that, but how the great job that the Clean Water Council is working with farmers and then getting, you know, the certification program and just doing a great job there. Just kind of question, again, it's not as, I liked how Chair McDonald framed it, but it's not as important as having drinking water that, Representative Cha and Dibble were talking about, but it's also important. I would like to see the council look more at water quality in the metro, and well, actually, for that matter, statewide with invasives, and you know, to make like the lakes more swimmable, fishable, drinkable in the metro? I know you've had a lot of lakes that are delisted. Mm-hmm. Some of them are in the metro, I know, like the one in Stillwater, but others I'm aware of too. But these invasives that are statewide really affect the use and the ability of the quality of the water. And I just wish you'd figure out a way to spend some of your funds on investing, and maybe you are, and I'm not aware of it to the extent, or maybe it needs to be grown, because a lot of those projects are left to local lake groups to fund and to, you know, to treat a lake. But it seems like the state should be more involved in treating them, because, you know, these often the metro lakes, for example, are feeders to get out, and then if you have a interest, then you're likely to go out and use the lakes in Scrabble and Representative Heitzman's districts. But you know, a lot of people have to start at home, and the majority of our Minnesota population live in the metro. So I challenge you to look more at the metro, you know, for the invasives and the quality of the metro lakes, and, well, the quality of lakes, I should say, and just figure out a way to treat them for invasives and other water qualities too. Anyways, thank you.
Jen Katie, do you want to respond?
Yeah, I'm happy to provide a brief response first. Thank you for that challenge and encouragement. I'll make sure to carry that back too. I know it was a number of years ago, and I'm trying to think that if this even predates you, Chair Barton, but the policy, there was a discussion on the Clean Water Council that established a policy that encouraged the council to move away from investing in addressing AIS across the state, but that doesn't take them the responsibility away from the policy work that we're doing, and is often a conversation that that comes back to when we're talking about clarity, when we're talking about challenges, and just acknowledging that, you know, work that we're doing on shoreline stabilization or in-lake treatments, there is that hand-in-hand discussion that has to take place with thinking about AIS as well. I'm happy to bring back that encouragement to take a look at treatments. I do also just want to note, even as we're talking about things like wake boats, and we're talking about the amount of water that is retained within the ballast for these lake boats and carried from one lake to another, like there's things like that where AIS is a part of those conversations too, even if it's not something that is the first thing that you think about when we're bringing up some of these topics.
All right. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you, Jen Cater, for welcome to the committee. It was nice meeting you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right. Do we still have Kelly Pennington here from DNR? Yeah, if you could come back to the testifying table. I believe Chair Lilly has one more question for you.
Thank you, Madam. Go ahead, Madam Chair. And I'll just kind of get going while you're, because I know we're punched for time, but I'm sorry. I was a little tired when I first came in this morning. Wasn't at full game. It took a while for my coffee to kick in. But Representative Heitzman and I were real involved with getting the barrier included in the Lessard bill in, I think, 24 it was or whatever, and then a lot of money and a big investment, and really, it's really important to Minnesota that we do this. And I'm glad that the chair has decided to bring this up as a, you know, to cover it. I mean, it's just vital for to do it and the timeliness to go after it. So I guess my question is, I didn't really totally get it. It sounds like there's some. Are we going to meet the deadline, I guess, is what I want to know. How are we doing really quick? And then it's just so important. I think the money was supposed to go to the barrier, not so much some of this trapping. I'm not against trapping or anything or, like, having multiple attacks, but I thought the money that was really supposed to go to the barrier and then try to – I'm just really hoping we can get it in and in place and get going on it, because every day scares the devil out of me. And – anyways, thank you.
Kelly Pennington? Yeah. Go ahead.
Chair, members, the appropriation is available through June 2029. We were appropriated $12 million over those 5 years. It's true that in the appropriation language, the focus is certainly on the lock deterrent at Lock and Dam 5 on the Mississippi River. There's some language in there that other strategies could be included as funds are available. So in our original accomplishment plan to the Lessard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council, we included the need for some multi-pronged strategies, really, at Lock and Dam 5, just because a lock deterrent won't reach the level of effectiveness for preventing upstream movement of invasive carp that I think we'd all like to see. So included in that was the trap and sort system, which is an idea that would remove invasive carp, particularly focusing on the area where the deterrent would be installed, to prevent fish from challenging the deterrent over and over again, and thereby like supporting the effectiveness of the lock deterrent. So it's really integral to the effectiveness of the lock deterrent to do that. That said, we've been conscious of the focus on the lock deterrent with respect to both the funding and the deadlines, and just recently have gotten some more preliminary estimates from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers based on other deterrents similar to this one, sort of what the projected costs would be at Lock and Dam 5. Like I said, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is also working on the design, and through that process, we'll get better estimates of the actual cost for the lock deterrent itself. So that continues to be our priority, continues to be on track for installation by the appropriation deadline of June 2029.
Chair Lilly?
No, thank you, and thank you, and I'm sorry I wasn't awake earlier. And then just a quick, really, really quick, is Wisconsin participating yet? Because they were not involved in the beginning.
Kelly Pennington.
Thank you, Chair, members. Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is among the partners on our interagency technical team. So since about July 2024, we've really depended on the expertise and knowledge that partners, including Wisconsin DNR and other federal agencies, have brought to this project.
All right, Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Thank you.
One more. Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll make some comments less than a minute. Just want to highlight for members, there is a letter from great organization MinFish in your packet, and they're really looking to see the committee continue to support and make sure that this project happens. And I think that I can speak for members here. If anybody disagrees, I'd be shocked that we're at all walking away from this. This has to happen. If we get this wrong, our grandchildren will be using bad words when they reference us. The impact to Minnesota's waters, if we do not stop invasive carp, is probably impossible to calculate. So, yep, get this project done. Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, Chair McDonald?
Madam Chair, just to mention that we're not meeting next week. We're on Easter break, and the next meeting will be April 8th, and we have a big lineup. It's going to be a really big meeting, really big meeting. Ms. Zipko, you'll send out the details?
I have no idea what we're doing.
We have no idea what we're doing yet, but so we're open for... But April 8th will be our next meeting here at Legacy, Madam Chair.
All right, duly noted. Thank you, members, and this committee is adjourned.